So welcome, everyone, as we study this fabulous text together. We're now at Chapter 3, and in Chapter 3, we continue with offerings. We move through offerings to all of the rest of the components of the seven-limb prayer, rejoicing, requesting, beseeching, and dedication, and then we get to the Bodhisattva commitment itself. For the people who are coming for this first time, we're doing Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva, and this is a classic foundational text, and it's used by all of Mahayana Buddhists, so it would be Buddhist in almost all of the Asian countries. And now in this day and age, when their walls of prejudice are falling, there's not so much distinction among the different kinds of Buddhists, and we're all sharing texts. So we could say this is one of the most universal texts that's being studied. And the reason it's studied so much is because it offers a complete path, step by step, that it reflects multiple training systems. And the poetry in it is particularly beautiful. When I'm talking about multiple training systems, we can think of it really, really simply, and so we'll start with that, and then I'll begin to show you in this chapter some of the other systems and why the systems are important. We were starting with just a very simple prayer that's in the dedication, page 24 in our prayer books here. Bodhicitta, the excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher. So the first chapter talks about this incredible concept of bodhicitta, which is loving kindness and compassion mixed with an understanding of the nature of reality, which broadly we might say is illusory or mixed with emptiness. But for the purposes of our understanding today, this text, I'm just going to say fearlessness, because I think that that really addresses why emptiness is so crucial to loving kindness and compassion. We come to Buddhism a lot of times because we're suffering, but we also come inspired by the great compassion and kindness. And the demonstrated fearlessness in the loving kindness and compassion is told by the different lineages of the history of all of these people who've accomplished this fearless open heart. I think fearlessness is a good word for our purposes right now. So we have this bodhicitta. The first three chapters focus on where it is unborn, may it arise. So we are drawn to it. We have compassionate minds, but we also have a sense of fear of maybe it's not possible to address the suffering of all the beings. And we have great compassion for all of the people in the Philippines, but they seem far away and we don't know how to help. Possibly one of our reactions is not knowing how to help the vastness of the immediate suffering. These studies take us through the trainings to be more fearless, more effective, and expand that capacity of kindness and compassion until there's no distinction. There's no inner and outer. There's no over there, the Philippines, and there's no over here, me and mine. And that's why this text is considered so brilliant. Because not only does he take you through the stages of training, he does it in a very human and vulnerable way, addressing his shortcomings along the way and giving himself pep talks. So that's one of the things I really love about it. This prayer is very accessible. We all want to have a larger heart, and we want to learn how we do it. The first step in terms of our training is to soften that heart. And one of the recommendations of how to soften our heart is this seven-limb offering. So if you go to page 6, we repeat this prayer that we do fairly regularly in the Drikung. You think of the Serkangma prayer, which is this gorgeous prayer of making bigger and bigger offerings. To understand how to begin to have a soft heart that actually wants to take the training, determined to take a training, you start in little steps, and you start by learning to look at the example of some of the great teachers, looking at the example of Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, and not thinking of them as so distinctly different, but thinking of them as having the same potential you have. And you start then with an honest assessment of where you are, the sense of personal transparency, and that was what was covered in the second chapter. We want to start practicing generosity. We want to give to all the people who are suffering. Then immediately we start to put our hand in our pocket and think, well, maybe I can give half of what I have. Oh, I might need it. Maybe we can give a quarter of what I have. Oh, I'm not sure about that. You know, so there's that sense of fear arising. And so we begin with just simply the aspirations so we can look to see what is going on in our mind. So it triggers where our growing edge is. Part of the training for ages is just looking at your intention, cultivating that intention, cultivating the aspiration, and then see what it triggers so that you can find where are the hard parts of your mind that you have to soften. So these seven limbs of offering, confession, rejoicing, beseeching, and praying, now we're at rejoicing in chapter 3. And offering is so crucial, it filters through many, many of the chapters. So we're also going to look at offering the body more fearlessly today. But it begins with rejoicing. Rejoicing is a tremendously interesting practice. I noticed that when I think of the four immeasurables, we think of loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and rejoicing. The first three are always pretty clear to me. You know, I want to learn more about loving kindness, so there are lots of trainings in loving kindness. You can read about them. We teach a training in loving kindness very regularly. We recognize the need for compassion, so we do lots of compassion training. We recognize that we lose our temper a lot, so we can totally access why we need equanimity. But then we get to rejoicing. Rejoicing I don't find to be the most accessible of why it's a profound training. Like the offerings that we've covered, he starts taking rejoicing in a really step-by-step profound way, how you can really expand how you think about rejoicing and what that training brings up for you. Rejoicing is classically considered to be the antidote to jealousy. And it's said that jealousy is one of the things that keeps our mind really hard, allows us not to see in the world the things that would be helpful and beneficial to us. So they bring up two of Buddha's cousins, Devadatta and one of his other cousins, that lived with Buddha for their whole lives, but they hated it the whole time. They were always angry and jealous of the Buddha because, you know, he had thousands of followers and they were all nice to him. They heard the same teachings that everybody else heard. Everybody else was getting enlightened. They stayed hard as a rock because they were jealous. They had a filter that they couldn't see and understand what was going on because they were jealous the whole time. So we see immediately how that can be a great failing. Let's go to the first verse. With joy I celebrate the virtue that relieves all beings from the sorrows of the states of loss and places those who languish in the realms of bliss. Shantideva begins with just rejoicing in general virtue. We know that positive steps have positive results karmically, and negative steps have negative results karmically. So we're always training a neural pathway. We're always adding karmic seeds of one kind or another. So he starts with, isn't it just incredible? Can I rejoice in the fact that actually if you do a positive thing, it's beneficial and will gradually remove you from a sorrowful, unhappy state? So just the fact that positive brings positive is his first level of rejoicing, the fact that the nature of reality works the way it works. And then I rejoice in the virtue that creates the cause of gaining the enlightened state and celebrate the freedom won by living beings from the round of pain. He so values the path and the process that he just takes the first step. So, for instance, here in the U.S., we're thinking of Thanksgiving coming up, and we think of families sharing a meal. And we wouldn't say necessarily that people are doing that so they can gain enlightenment or they can end suffering for all sentient beings, although that could be a potential if you set that aspiration, dedication along with your Thanksgiving. But just a simple step of people sharing food, isn't that a positive state? Eventually, that will be the cause of freedom from samsara and the round of suffering. Then he celebrates the next series of stages of the path towards enlightenment. And in the Buddhahood of the protectors, I delight, and in the stages of the Buddha's offering. The Buddhas and all of the bodhisattvas, all of the people who are training towards enlightenment, every one of their actions. So he's resulting in the cause of enlightenment and the result of enlightenment. just in the fact that the Dharma works. Then he results in the intention ocean of great good that seeks to place all beings in the state of bliss and every action for the benefit of all, such as my delight and all my joy. The intention, the ocean of great good, that's another way of talking about aspiration bodhicitta. That extraordinary ocean, the fact that it exists and that the fact that we can even have a thought of benefiting all sentient beings. The fact that that thought can arise anywhere for any group of people, rejoicing in that. And every action for the benefit of all, such as my delight and all my joy. One of the things that I found tremendously interesting in contemplating this chapter for the talk today is the difference between rejoicing and our culture. I really started thinking about how particularly our culture, our Western culture, and maybe even particularly the U.S., has created such a culture of criticism and sarcasm, the humor of putting people down. You know, who can come up first with the most detrimental, funny kind of quip that denigrates somebody. So there's that sense that our whole culture is based on competition. Our humor is based on competition. Our way of thinking about each other, our first thought in many ways reflects our culture. And this is the opposite of that. It's finding a way to rejoice in any piece of virtue you can find in any act. So instead of thinking what is the fun you can make that has the edge of criticism, it's more where can you find that peace or moment of virtue. And it just brought up for me the whole sort of frame of mind that we're often in. I have a niece who has a wonderful sense of humor. She loves Jon Stewart. Her sense of humor that she applies to everything is that kind of, and it can be very funny, but making fun of as opposed to finding virtue in every situation and every act. So the idea of rejoicing in the simple positive things, we even think of as, well, that's being New Agey or being Pollyanna-ish. But if we think about that we want to soften all our edges and open to the benefits and blessings, rejoicing is really an incredible teaching just on how we carry our minds in terms of being positive in a very interesting kind of way. And then the idea of rejoicing in all of the actions, even the actions of your enemies, not to mention your competitors at work or whatever, you see how quickly our habits, my habits, slide into wanting to make fun of a success or bring down a success. There's an example that's used a lot of crabs trying to get out of a basket. They climb on top of each other. And we have a culture of climbing on top of each other like that. So rejoicing is quite an incredible antidote just to look at, to shine a light on how often we're not rejoicing. That's the part I find interesting. You could rejoice in this moment, and you choose not to. You choose to take a different tack. So this immeasurable, this limb, this way of making accumulation is asking us to open to that and to start training in that and train in rejoicing. And I know how much I enjoy being around the people who are always rejoicing. You know, we can see actually what a wonderful quality it is. There's a story about, it's called the story of King Prajnit. And he was this incredible, wealthy, powerful king. And the Buddha was coming to his town. He created this gigantic feast, and he gave gifts to everybody, and he made this incredible meal, and the Buddha was ushered in with rose petals, and, you know, everything was fabulous. It was just gorgeous. There was a beggar sitting outside, and that beggar was absolutely had no ego, and she was just sitting there saying, "Isn't this wonderful?" She wasn't thinking, "Why wasn't I invited?" Or, "I wish I had some of that nice food," or, "Why is he paying his servants instead of cutting off food stamps for me?" She just simply rejoiced in everything that was happening. At the end of the feast, the king says to the Buddha, knowing he had done such a good job, knowing that he had created a perfect event, he says to the Buddha, "Okay, Buddha, this was so lovely. Thank you for coming. And I just want to check and see, you know, how I'm doing. Who made the most offering to you today? Who did the best offering? You know, I know the subjects were giving you gifts and everything. We would like you to enlighten us." And the Buddha said, "Well, this lovely lady sitting right side out the door, right outside the door, made the best offering today. Because she, by rejoicing, participated in all the offerings of all the king and all the subjects to the Buddha, and actually made the most pure offering. So that's a wonderful sense of how we can take this to great extent. Then going to verse 5, and so I join my hands and pray, the Buddhas who reside in every quarter, kindle now the Dharma's light for those who grope bewildered in the dark of suffering. One of the interesting things about Buddhism is it's never proselytized. We're moving now towards how important it is to request the Dharma to be taught. So teachers don't actually teach the Dharma unless they're asked to teach the Dharma. They don't just go out and set up something or start crying on the street corners. Even when the Buddha first was enlightened, the gods Indra appeared to him with gifts saying, please teach. And so there's that sense of wanting our hearts to be open, preparing ourselves for the teaching and even asking for the teaching. So in here, in the shrine room, we see these two thrones, these beautiful seats that we've created that are beautifully painted and constructed. And we have beautiful cloths on them because they are the request to teach. When you want a teacher to come, you build the chair for them to teach as an invitation. The fifth of the seven limbs is requesting the teachers to teach. And then the sixth is beseeching that they don't pass away, that they stay. So verse number 6, I join my hands beseeching the enlightened ones who wish to pass beyond the bounds of sorrow. Do not leave us in our ignorance. Remain among us for unnumbered ages. And it said that when Buddha was preparing to die, one of his monks made a request that he stayed longer, and he stayed for another few months. Those of us who come regularly, you know, we have the long life prayers for our teachers at the end, and we're requesting them, particularly now they're aged, to stay here and teach. So from the ultimate perspective, there's no coming and going, but from the relative perspective, the teachers push us out of the nest. They give the appearance of death and leaving us so that we will study hard and be ready to keep going, that we're not dependent on them, that we're really taking the practices into our hands and are ready to put them into effect. And then dedication, the last of the seven limbs. And through these actions now performed, by all the virtues I have just amassed, may all the pain of every living being be wholly scattered and destroyed. And this refers to the concept of merit. The story of the king, when he was giving all the gifts to the Buddha and creating the good lunch, the reason his offering wasn't as perfect is was for him it was a little bit more of an exchange. I should be getting something back because I have created this beautiful event. I should be getting fame. I should get it prestige. In some ways, when we approach things, we have a sense of, I want to make sure I get enlightened. I want to make sure that I am released from suffering. There's a sense of, well, maybe doing all these teachings will in some way, receiving all these teachings are some way going to protect me. So instead of feeling like we have to hold on to all the good that we're doing and all the resulting positive merit that's coming towards us, we immediately offer it for all sentient beings. And the example that's given for merit, which I find so interesting, I love these very graphic examples that are very down to earth, is they say if you put a drop of water on a rock, it will evaporate very quickly. But if you mix a drop of water into the ocean, it will last forever. We know homeopathically it will just merge with the whole ocean, and it will always be there, always accessible, and good for all sentient beings. So the concept of merit is not protecting even the good works that you've done for some sense of, you know, in the Catholic sense, we would say if we do good deeds, we go to heaven. So not protecting heaven for yourself, but saying because of this, may all beings benefit. Now we get to some of the verses that are starting to perfect aspiration, the great classic ideal, the great poetry. You know, if I were thinking what would be the most beautiful thing to share with someone who didn't know Buddhism at all, it would be some of this poetry. I'll just read the next three verses. For all those ailing in the world, until their every sickness has been healed, then may I become for them the doctor, the nurse, the medicine itself. raining down a flood of food and drink, may I dispel the ills of thirst and famine. And in the ages marked by scarcity and want, may I appear as drink and sustenance. For all sentient beings poor and destitute, may I become a treasure ever plentiful, and lie before them closely in their reach, a varied source of all they might need. This not only is just extraordinary in terms of what it's expressing, may I be the doctor, the nurse, the medicine itself. It also refers to the stages that the Buddha went through in many various lives he had before he became a Buddha. When we talk about becoming the doctor, the nurse, the medicine itself, there was a time in the early bodhisattva stages of the Buddha where there was an incredible illness that struck the whole kingdom. And the king tried everything. He brought all the doctors in from all over the world. He brought every kind of medicine in from all over the world. But there ended up to be nothing he could do. And so he found someone who said that the only cure is this special kind of fish, the rohita fish. But none of them exist in this country. So the king prepared himself. He took a special shower. He put on perfect robes. And then he jumped into the water and turned into the fish. And they gathered the fish out of the water, and even while the fish was still alive, they divided it into millions of little pieces so that it could be given out to everyone in the land. We have all of these incredible examples of bodhisattvas who took the training step by step and got to the point where then they actually could become the medicine, literally, as well as making the aspiration that we can make now, saying, I wish I could. And then we get to the point where we actually can. Raining down a flood of food and drink, may I dispel the ills of thirst and famine. I mean, it's just gorgeous. And in the ages marked by scarcity and want, may I appear as drink and sustenance. So we think of the Tonglin practice that we do now in the Sunday morning meditation, and we think of the Philippines. So in this moment, may I become the blankets, may I become the drinking water, may I become the food that people need so desperately, may I become the nurse and the doctor and the medicine itself. And we train in this aspiration until we actually have the capacity to do that. And we see over time the Buddha had greater and greater capacity. There's the story of him becoming the food when he was a prince, came across on a hike through the mountains a starving tiger and the tiger cubs. And so he told his retinue to go on ahead, and he just jumped into the tiger's den to become the food. Not only is that a wonderful act, then we take a cautionary view and again go through the fact that it's step-by-step training and we are doing the aspiration stage, particularly when it comes to offering the body. So if we go to verse 11, my body thus and all my goods besides and all my merits gained and to be gained, I dedicate them all, withholding nothing, to bring about the benefit of beings. So we're getting ready. We know that when we have perfect peace of mind, there's no withholding, no self-protection. So we're practicing by imagining giving all of our goods, all of our merits to benefit people. We're experimenting with that to see when different barriers arise, when fear arises. And we're strengthening ourselves. Nirvana is attained by giving all. Nirvana is the object of all my striving. Everything, therefore, must be abandoned, and it's best to give it all to others. So we're going to have to give away everything anyway. We're going to have to let go of our grasping and attachment. It's best to give it to people who can benefit than, you know, so storm comes through, blows away everything and scatters it, and we didn't have the chance to give it away. Then verse 13, this body I have given up. I want to go a little bit into preparation before we go into this verse, because now we're getting towards the really scary. This is written intentionally to trigger you, because we want to see where we are. So on the first round is, okay, we want to look at what comes up. On the second round, we have confidence that Shantideva actually is trying to encourage us. So he's not trying to scare us so much that we run out the door. And he's also trying to share with us the kind of logic and preparation that the bodhisattvas use themselves. So when I was reading the next series of verses, I found Pema Chodron's commentary very helpful because she immediately went to Martin Luther King and Gandhi. Now, if you're thinking about what does he tell himself the day before he goes on the big march, knowing that there could be violence, but at the same time knowing that the marches in the long run are going to benefit beings, how does he bring up for himself the strength of courage? The Dalai Lama was talking to us at the last teaching on how he drew courage from some of these teachings before he made the escape from Tibet, knowing that there would be violence the next day and so many of his people would suffer. We're looking for the root of our fear. And we're looking for the particular training that overcomes the root. And we know that in some ways we're blind to the roots of our fear. We're drawing that up in order to look at it. This body I have given up to serve the pleasure of all living beings. Let them kill, beat, and slander it, and do to it whatever they desire. And though they treat it like a toy, or make of it the butt of every mockery, my body has been given to them. There is no use now to make so much of it. And so let beings do to me whatever does not bring them injury. Whenever they catch sight of me, let this not fail to bring them benefit. And if those who see me entertain a thought of anger or devotion, may these states supply the cause whereby their good and wishes are fulfilled. So that's an incredible, incredible series of verses. And when I was directed to think of Martin Luther King, the first thing I did is I went and read his speech on loving kindness. And at the beginning of the speech on loving kindness, he said, my doctor told me to stay in bed today, but I came to teach this sermon, and then I'll follow my doctor's advice. So there's the sense of seeing the greater good. He immediately said to himself, or I imagine him saying to myself, the greater good is to give this speech. And we know how long after his death this speech is benefiting beings. It's one of his most famous speeches, and really, truly one of the most beautiful speeches. So the preciousness, am I going to have a little ill health due to this? He let go of that because he had already given away his body to serve others, desensitizing his sense of having to protect in a way that he is able to do then. So we're encouraged to give of our bodies as we are able, starting small and giving larger and larger and larger ways. At that point, the great bodhisattva that he was, he could allow himself not to worry about any resulting ill health. I might worry about ill health right now. And one of the examples in terms of giving the body, they say that you're not encouraged in any way to think of doing that until you can give it like a vegetable, like a simple vegetable from your garden. And so we'll see how different bodhisattvas have worked with this training to go from I'm going to come help clean the shrine room, to I'm going to come do something even when I'm a little sick and I might get sicker, to I no longer see the relative, I see the absolute, and ultimately there's no sickness. So it's taking us through stages. And so we're looking at these verses in the sense of how is Shantideva encouraging us, as opposed to this sounds, not only is this scary, but maybe this is bad advice, unpsychologically sound advice. So we're looking at it from a different perspective. And then you can think of marches, you can think of Gandhi's marches, and we can think of Nelson Mandela. And though they treat it like a toy or make it the butt of every mockery, my body has been given up to them. There's no use now to make so much of it. You see the enemies making a mock of the body, but from our side, we're not making so much of a preciousness or a protection of our body itself, even though we're in the middle of a situation where there's great difficulty. And so let beings do to me whatever does not bring them injury. So this is the important line. It's not asking beings, it's not going in foolishly where people would injure you, because we know if someone injures someone, they are harmed. So we're not going to the point, we're not looking at the understanding that we're placing ourselves in harm's way, because that actually, the person who is beating someone, that person is being harmed. But the greater levels of understanding of emptiness, the bodhisattvas are able to comprehend emptiness in a different way and comprehend the illusory nature of things in a different way, and see that sometimes the karmic connection in the long run is going to bring someone greater benefit. So if we think of Nelson Mandela's jailer, who became his friend and then became such a supporter of changing the whole view of apartheid in South Africa, you can see how the relationship of a perpetrator of violence to someone who's a great bodhisattva, that connection, even though it's a harmful connection in the beginning, can be the source of their enlightenment directly. Different levels of bodhisattvas aren't injured in these situations. They see the illusory nature of things, and they're allowing themselves to move through situations so that they can be in service to beings. So we think of Kishtagarbha. How does he get the fearlessness to make the resolve to always be in the hell realms? So if he's always with beings in the hell realms, it's so he can be a point of inspiration in those hell realms, or a point of bodhicitta to arise in the hell realms just by the sight of him, even though we imagine, you know, terrible things going on all the time. So do you see what's being said in these verses, even though they sound wild at first? Let those, even whoever, if those who see me entertain a thought of anger or devotion, may these states supply the cause whereby their good and wishes are fulfilled. This verse is so important. Kempo Sultram in the Kagyu tradition teaches it at a song and has all his students singing it. So you start to see, even those people who are angry with you, even those people who are enemies, one way of looking at, if they think of me even due to anger, even due to any of the afflictive emotions, just that thought in the mind that arises, that's the picture, let's say, of the robes, or of, if we were doing like our connection to the Dalai Lama or Venerable Dahani, just the thought of it arises even in anger, may it turn them towards a thought that connects them to enlightenment. So we think of people that we've had difficulties with, and people that we have difficulties with. When we think of them, when they think of us, instead of renewing the argument, the conflict, may the thought arising lead that person to what is good for them and beneficial for them. May some aspect of that thought then lead them eventually towards enlightenment. So when we get to the patience chapter, believe me, we go into even more detail on how to work with these things that seem at first to be counterintuitive. And I totally agree that it seems counterintuitive at first. But it will progress as we go along. All those who slight me to my face or do me any other evil, even those who blame or disparage me, may they attain the fortune of enlightenment. And now we get more aspirations again. So the whole rest of the book is going to be on training in how to work with these kinds of verses, how to work with may all enemies benefit and attain enlightenment. And he's giving you a preview. So he's saying, okay, when we say all sentient beings, when we make that aspiration, we mean even our enemies, even those who slight me or do me any evil, blame or disparage me. And we're going to see how to cultivate not only the mental training, but eventually the actual training of helping them to attain the fortune of enlightenment. And now we get to some of the extraordinary opening up into the poetry of what that means. May I be a guard for those who are protectorless, a guide for those who journey on the road, even for those who wish to grow across the water. May I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an isle for those who yearn for landfall, and a lamp for those who long for light, and for those who need a resting place, a bed. For all who need a servant, may I be their slave. May I be a wishing jewel, the vase of plenty, a word of power and the supreme healing. May I be the tree of miracles, and for every being the abundant cow. These are some of my favorite verses, just so lovely. And again, it's not only poetry. We understand it to be in many ways bodhisattvas can actually manifest in the world. There are no limit to the different ways that bodhisattvas and Buddhas can benefit beings. So even for those who wish to go across the water, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. when His Holiness Chetsang Rinpoche was leaving Tibet, he was traveling through the mountains alone, and mostly at night, because he didn't want other people to get in trouble for helping him. And so he got to a point where there was a big crevice that was impassable. And he was there, and then all of a sudden people came from behind him with a log to go across the crevice. And then he crossed the crevice and didn't see the people again. He doesn't declare this a miracle, but when he described the situation, there was the need, then people carrying the bridge arose in the moment of need. So there's that sense of, as we progress along the path, not only can we do the simple positive things, we can do greater and greater levels of things, and then limitless kinds of things. So these verses have just been inspiring people for centuries and centuries. May I be an isle for those who long landfall. And they say that the line, for all who need a servant, may I be their slave. You know, when people are sick and elderly, how they just need help. And may I just be the person who comes in and does whatever is needed. There's the sense in that. When people need money, can I be the money? When they need food, can I be the food? For every being, the abundant cow, whatever is needed to sustain and make people joyful. And then he gets to, may I even be the planet that sustains all of life. You know, I can be all these different things. May I be the planet that allows life to happen, like the earth and other great elements, and like space itself, may I remain forever to support the lives of boundless beings by providing all that they might need. And then I'm going to read another translation that just is a little like the earth and the pervading elements enduring like the sky itself endures. For boundless multitudes of living beings, may I be their ground and sustenance. Thus, for every being that lives, as far are the limits of the sky, may I provide their nourishment and livelihood until they pass beyond the bonds of suffering. So we know that in the Native American view, there's that sense that one of the great aspirations after you die is to become a planet so that you can be the Mother Earth that sustains all of life. And in the Buddhist worldview, when there are suffering beings who need to encounter the teachings, who need to accumulate positive merit in order to refine their minds out of suffering, that meets with the bodhisattva aspiration to provide the place, and that's the beginning in terms of the story of the cosmos, of the elements coming together to form a planet. So it's the need met by the aspiration to be the planet. He tells us how scary it is. He tells us it can be done. There are many beings we can look to who have been done. And then he opens our hearts again with this extraordinary poetry of being the isle, the food, the medicine, even the planet itself. And then he invites us to make a commitment to train. So in the Buddhist tradition, we use the word vow, but it also is translated as commitment or resolve. And the sense is to make the commitment with the strength you have today and to keep training so that it continues to expand throughout your life. So there isn't a sense of, I can't do it, I can't go throw myself off the ledge to be the food for the tigers yet, so I should give up. The sense is, I resolve, since my potential is the same as the Buddha's potential, we all have the potential, my potential is the same as Martin Luther King's potential, how do I train to have that great heart mind that those people have given evidence? And so he says, just as the Buddhas of the past embraced the attitude of awakened mind, and in the precepts of the bodhisattvas, step by step abode and train, just as they had to go step by step to become the extraordinary beings that they are, just like that, I'm going to follow in their footsteps and train step by step. I'm going to take the first leaf of kale till I can give a whole bunch of kale. Kale is so common where we live, and it survives the frost, so we're looking at everybody's kale left in the garden. It's like giving one leaf of lettuce when you have a head of lettuce. And then when you have a head of lettuce and you can give that away, how can I give two? So you gradually start with that until you can give more and more and more. Just so, and for the benefit of beings, I will also have the attitude of mine, and in those precepts, step by step, I will train, I will abide and train myself. Not only is it important to go step by step, but when studying this aspect and looking at how the whole Buddhist path is described and looking at the different systems of the descriptions, I started to just contemplate, not only is it meant to be an inspiration, but it's also meant to help you say, I'm not going to stop too soon. I'm going to keep going limitlessly. I'm not going to stop when there's more growth to be done. So when we're looking at the Buddhist path as a whole, until we understand emptiness, we're meant to be training in the aspiration. I'm going to exchange the word, and I bet you'll understand it. Until we understand fearlessness, we're meant to be training in aspiration. It doesn't mean that we're waiting for us to do positive things until we're fully formed. It's to see how can we continuously work on our fearlessness until there's no fear left. You see what I mean? So we have these incredible prayers where the teachers are making more and more gigantic aspirations. We have Shantideva making more and more gigantic aspirations. And it's to help us understand that we can keep going with the aspirations, and there's a purpose for them to be larger and larger. There's a purpose for us always to see where our fear is and move beyond it so that there are no limits. I think particularly in our culture, which is seems to be marked by a lot of competitiveness, we also come in with a fair amount of arrogance saying, well, I should be able to do this. I should be able to be at least, you know, like maybe I'm not at the great scale, but I'm close to it. I should be able to start there without appreciating the significance of the step-by-step training. So until you have a direct experience of fearlessness or emptiness, the aspirations are a profound, profound training. From the text, we think of the five paths, and we think of the Bodhisattva Bhumis. And we have all of these classifications that, for those of you who are studying the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, sometimes they become really confusing, and why are we talking about these things? It's so as you become more and more capable, you don't lose sight that you can be profoundly more capable. That what a bodhisattva can do is, they say it's like a puddle in the hoof print of an ox is to the ocean. So that we always want to keep growing until there are no limits, simply until there are no limits to what we are able to understand. And I looked at some of the ways of explaining that, and he particularly is emphasizing that we come in with the altruistic intention, but it has to be infused with this fearlessness, this understanding of emptiness. And as we go through the book will help us understand where and how to apply the emptiness and the illusory nature of the relative reality so that our capacity increases. And he does that by now focusing on the six perfections. So these systems, the stages of the bodhisattva that increase in terms of what they're able to understand in meditation and what they're able to then put in practice, begins with giving again. And that's why giving is repeated so often throughout the text. So when the bodhisattva training begins, like the seven limb offering, it begins with giving. And now we'll go through giving and patience and discipline and joyful effort and eventually get to wisdom, with the poetry for each of those chapters. The sense is, if we were to compare it to what's going on in the Philippines right now, and what appears like hopelessness, is when we get to the deeper levels of understanding, of emptiness, we see that we continue going and going and going, doing everything we can, but without any sense of self to protect, understanding that the immediacy of suffering is real, and in the long run, people are dying and being born in samsara, and the bigger offering is to help them to be released from samsara altogether. And that the goal of accomplishing or solving is is an attachment to some kind of result. You do everything with everything you have without a sense of having to hope for a solution or feeling it can't be done. That it's millennia, and within the sense of understanding that there's no inside or no outside, there's no goal to complete. They're simply serving whatever is needed, whatever time it arises, with nothing to protect and no actual offering and no actual recipient. Sort of moving fluidly through all of samsara, not decrying immediacy of the relative reality, but not letting it be a cause of fear or hopelessness. Is that starting to resonate a little bit? It's what allows you, when there's a never-ending line knocking at the door, to keep joyfully continuing with whatever is presently there, asking for help or assistance. We will get there, I promise you. So, what we're saying when we take the Bodhisattva vow is that, or the making the Bodhisattva commitment, is that we're going to engage in this training, that we're not going to be afraid of the training, that we're going to look at the step-by-step understanding, we're going to look at the six perfections, each in order, and we're going to keep going as our teachers did until we are fully open, fully fearless. And the key to emptiness is, without understanding emptiness, you don't have the fearlessness to be in every situation. So going to verse 26, then he goes back to rejoicing again. Having made the commitment to engage, having made the commitment to begin the training, today my life has given fruit. This human state has now been well assumed. Today I take birth in Buddha's line and have become the Buddha's child and heir. In every way, then, I will undertake actions befitting such a rank, and I will do no act to mar or compromise this high and faultless family. For I'm like a blind man who has found a precious gem within a mound of filth. Exactly so, as though some strange chance the enlightened mind has come to birth in me. So their sense of him rejoicing that when we take the Bodhisattva vow, we become a child of the Buddha. We become a baby Bodhisattva. We have found in the midst of our mind, you know, with all the less than perfect thoughts, the less than perfect feelings, there's this gem of bodhicitta. So I found that gem. I know I have it. I'm going to now focus on expanding it. This is going to be the focus for the rest of my life. This is the draft of immortality that slays the Lord of Death, this gem that we found, the slaughterer of beings. This is the draft of immortality that slays the Lord of Death, the slaughterer of beings, the rich and unfailing treasure mine to heal the poverty of wanderers. It is the sovereign remedy that perfectly heals all maladies. It is the wishing tree bestowing rest on those who wander wearily the paths of existence. It is the universal vehicle that saves all wandering beings from the state of loss, the rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrows born of the afflictions. It is a mighty sun that utterly dispels the gloom and ignorance of wandering beings, the creamy butter rich and full, all churned from milk of the holy teaching. Living beings, wayfarers upon life's path, who wish to taste the riches of contentment, here before you is supreme bliss. Here, or ceaseless wanderers, is your fulfillment. So if we think of the story I told in the beginning about the beggar woman sitting outside the feast, was that woman suffering? She was not suffering. She was rejoicing. So that gem of bodhicitta within her, this is the remedy that perfectly heals all maladies. It is the wishing tree bestowing rest on those who wander wearily the pathways of existence. So the time that you were cultivating loving kindness and compassion, you're not engaged in the suffering of samsara. Your mind is resting from that, the weariness of the continuous round of afflictions in samsara, the sorrows of samsara. So we think of our mind, it can be directed towards hopelessness, or it can be directed towards bodhicitta and loving kindness. So when we're focused on that gem of mind, the loving kindness, then during that moment of time, we don't have the sorrows present. We don't have the maladies present. We may be sick. We may have a cancer diagnosis, but our mind is not focused on the fear or the illness. Our mind is focused, when we choose to, on, isn't this moment of being together precious? Isn't the first snowfall beautiful? You see what I mean? It is actually what cures the suffering. Where we put our mind is what cures the suffering or causes the suffering. And so, within sight of all the protectors, I summon every being, calling them to Buddhahood. Until that state is reached, to every earthly joy, may gods, demigods, and all the rest rejoice. So there's an incredible sense of having taken the vow. All the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are rejoicing. We're making the commitment that we continue into all beings are in that state. So now we have time for some questions. And I really invite you to enjoy and sort of revel in some of the poetry in this chapter, because it really is quite fantastic. The mighty sun that utterly dispels the gloom and ignorance of wandering beings, the creamy butter rich and full, all churned from the milk of the holy Dharma. You know, saying, you know, the bodhicitta, when we put it into practice, is like taking ordinary milk and making it into butter. Or like on a day-to-day, if all of a sudden the sun would come out and everything would be bright and warm again, particularly up here in Vermont as we move into winter, that bodhicitta is really the state of mind that brings us happiness and joy. This is exactly what he's doing. So remember the prayer I was saying, where does unborn may it arise? This is just arising bodhicitta into your heart. And then now all the chapters from now to the end are, okay, this is how you put it into practice. And the you know, we all have that feeling. For the people who are on the phone, Daichin was saying that in retreat, she could read this poetry and feel inspired, but then, of course, we all find it difficult the minute we step out our door. And the wisdom of saying step by step, and the wisdom of presenting, for instance, the Bodhisattva Bhumis, so that you see how the Bodhisattvas have moved step by step and which each stage of the Bodhisattva is like. When we define the Bodhisattva Bhumis, it's just showing you the different stages of retreat and putting it into action. That even the Bodhisattvas at the beginning are just trying to comprehend the understanding and apply that. And we who are not yet Bodhisattvas are just trying to build our aspiration and learn how to navigate once we start moving in the world. And so he's saying, okay, let's build the aspiration. Let's look at that it's step by step. I want to warn you that you're talking about giving away everything. You're talking about giving away your bodies eventually. Let's look at where our fear is, and now let's learn exactly how step by step. So I wanted to give you a preview of the next chapter, because here we have, okay, we've taken the Bodhisattva vow, all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are rejoicing. The next chapter, he says, oh my goodness, I can't even control my own emotions. What folly, what have I promised? It's almost the next verse. So, I've compromised my integrity by making such a promise that I can't keep. What have I done? And then he takes us step by step. This is what you do. This is where you start. This is the beginning. That's the mixture in this text that I find so wonderful and so interesting. What he helps us understand is the stages of doing that. So, like, for instance, we have a friend who's really sick right now. So some people go and visit. So that's one way of offering the body. Some people might even not be able to visit, but they make a phone call. Some people go and move in with the person and spend a week or a month, you know, as the phrase said, if someone needs help, may I become their servant. And then even with greater understanding, there was the king who, in that story, his body could be the medicine, so he offered directly his body with the understanding that he could do that because he did have the understanding that the relative and the absolute, Kenshin Konsha Gyaltsa sometimes says, like different sides of the same palm. You know, that the absolute in the great minds are realized, coexist or are able to be seen at the same time. And so you could offer your body knowing that you were part of the essential fabric of wisdom and love. There's no me and my. There's a temporary skin and flesh that can become the medicine for another being that's temporary skin and flesh. Part of relative reality as we understand it, as well as the fabric of the Dharmakaya, we would express it in Buddhism. And now he's going to take us step by step, starting with training our minds directly, just like the simple meditation directions I gave this morning, through how do you stay patient when you're on the march with Martin Luther King and people are actively yelling at you, as opposed to the aspiration, may I be able to do it, what do you do in the heat of the moment? That's the progression as the chapters keep going. Until there are people suffering in the Philippines at this moment, how is their cry not outside? And the same as the cry of myself or who I think of as my best beloved. So he will take us until we can join him at that realization, giving what's needed. A question on the phone?
Yes, it's Ann Lucas.
Hey, hi, Ann.
Hi. You and I had a conversation, and at one point it seems relevant to this, which is how do you not use these teachings as self-abuse? You know, I had a thought that perhaps celebrating the small successes of when you are able to give could help to build that skill rather than only seeing what you can't do yet. So I'm just looking for guidance on that.
Right, and that's a very important point, and I wanted to make sure we were clear about that. So Pema Chodron, in her book, No Time to Lose, it's another wonderful commentary on the Bodhisattva's way of life. She was saying when she first read the verses on offering the body, she thought they were appalling because they sound like self-abuse. So what is the difference between self-abuse and these verses? And so the key, she was saying, is first of all, trusting that Shantideva was writing the verses to encourage us. And he was writing them from a vast and wise perspective, not a small perspective. So the key in it is you're not injuring yourself and you're not allowing others to injure themselves. So you're walking into situations for which you've prepared and you're evaluating as you go, am I prepared for this situation or not? So just as we were saying, one person might make a phone call and one person might move in to take care of somebody. And with the concept of rejoicing that we've been doing today, so there's, I can take time out of my day to make a phone call, I am going to rejoice in that as opposed to feel guilty that I can't do more, right? When the person is moving in, I'm going to rejoice in what they're doing instead of feeling, I can't do that, there's something wrong with me. I couldn't leave my life for a month. You know, I wish I could, you know, heading straight into guilt. So we're combining the quality of rejoicing. We're not injuring ourselves. So when Naropa was studying with Tilopa, Tilopa would keep giving Naropa these horrifying things to do, but it was in relative reality until Naropa could see that it was all illusion. He would say, well, if you want to study with me, jump off the cliff. Naropa would think, are you crazy?
Mm-hmm.
This is going to hurt me. This is nuts. Until the word Naropa means something like broken bones. Until he got from the perspective of the absolute, there is no being that's being harmed. Because he would jump off the cliff, he would break all his bones, Tilopa would snap his fingers, and he would be fine again. So he got the point of fearlessness when he could see that if we looked at things from the absolute, there is continuously the relative happening, and you can continuously move in and out and benefit without fearing that there's something to protect. You will die one day, and then you will be reborn. All the people you're helping will die one day, and then they'll be reborn. What are the actions that will help lift them out of the continuous cycle of birth and life and death and all the mistakes and all of the anger and all of the killing and war? So we're looking to see how can we act in such a way that's not injuring others. Naropa wasn't being injured by his teacher. It wasn't abuse, because both of them were at the point where they could handle that training. Whereas when the Tibetans talk about that, they would say, and there are probably no teachers alive like that now, and you are not Naropa. So so we're training at the head of lettuce stage. Can I give away one leaf without thinking it was too much? Maybe I won't have enough for lunch tomorrow, right? And then we start there, and we go more and more and more. So it's not meant to be self-abusive. It's meant to give you perspective of what the possibility is, as well as what can you do now, and rejoice in what you can do now. We're asking that our boundaries and limits appear to us so we can see them, so we can go beyond them. Can we keep a hold of, like, the absolute of what's possible and realistically train where we are? So some people have said to me that they're afraid of taking the Bodhisattva vow, because they're afraid to make a promise they can't keep. So I just want to emphasize again that the process of, sometimes the word vow is difficult. Let's talk about commitment or resolve, and realize that that's a translation. Vow, the word vow is a translation. That we're being asked to, having the natural kindness and compassion that we have, be our focus, and to jump into the potential of what we can become and make the commitment and resolve to enter into that training. So you're not supposed to be already there. You're supposed to be willing and ready to be open. And so if you look at the prayers that we do every day, we're actually taking the refuge and the Bodhisattva vow when we say these prayers. It's good to have a ceremony, it's good to have a ritual, it's good to have an inspiring being like the Dalai Lama when you're taking the vows, but you don't have to have even anybody there. You don't have to have a ritual. You only need to have, you didn't even have to have the picture of anyone to take the Bodhisattva vow. You only have to have the thought in your mind that that potential exists, that capacity exists, I can see it without, I trust that it's within, and I resolve to train. And it said when you repeat the Bodhisattva vow three times, which we already always do in the book, you're actually taking the vow. And you just commit to training over and over again. And the culture of the Tibetans, of Tibetan Buddhism, and the Bodhisattva vow is all of Mahayana Buddhism, is it will present extensive training, which we relate to in terms of guilt. Oh, I've broken the vow. You know, when we make a mistake. But that's not the view of the vow. The view is I'm entering into training. The greatest beings can be perfect. The middle beings can look at all the rules and accomplish the rules. And the ordinary beings just resolve not to exclude anyone from their heart. Whenever someone arises like an annoyance, like an enemy, I will strive not to exclude them from my heart. I resolve to find a way to work with the situation. And so there is wonderful training, but it's nothing to be afraid of or to provoke guilt. It's meant you can expand into always doing this. You can expand into always giving away things, to always teaching when people need teaching, to always helping the sick when they're sick. But you're not meant to be accomplished. And then, as I was saying before, until you have direct experience of emptiness, you're working on creating the aspiration and enlarging that aspiration and avoiding harming others. I think that helps us understand when we do take action and it's mixed with something about our image, something about our actions are mixed until the good and the self-serving is mixed until we reach more and more levels of heart. Not a bad thing. It's a natural stage of progression as we train. The good thing is that the light is on and we see what we're doing. Yeah, so Daichin is asking for an antidote in the moment as you're making an error. Yeah, rejoicing that you can see the error and retaking the vow immediately or as soon as you can. You know, and or correcting in the moment as quickly as you can the action that you've taken. You're like, oh, I'm so sorry. I said such a stupid thing to you. I'm so sorry. As opposed to, you know, I don't want to admit that I did anything. You're absolutely right, Janet. So I think that's where language becomes an issue in terms of vow and brokenness. So there is a sense of what actions are, if you were to exclude someone from your heart and let that develop into hatred, you would be letting go of your resolve to keep training. Whereas, you know, there's a sense of it immediately noticing and engaging in opening to the training again. You're right, there isn't a sense of breaking as we might understand it loosely. And you take the vow again. you take it over and over and over again. You're encouraged to take it daily, even six times a day. May I give rise to this in my mind, just like the great ones, may I follow step by step. I think gratitude is included in rejoicing and it's included in devotion. And I think you would say in the first and second chapters we're focused a lot on gratitude. Yeah. Yeah, appreciation. As we move through the text, he gets more and more specific to aspects of things. In the Buddhist culture, the sense of making offerings is an expression of gratitude. And so it filters throughout. And there's, again, beautiful language for extending that greater and greater gratitude. In that case, they're sort of aspects of themselves. That gratitude would be softer and rejoicing would be, you know, more flamboyant gratitude. Okay, so we can rejoice in studying together. What, Janet? Well, I think that I remember that he was sort of a grumpy teacher. I remember that quote from him. He was, you know, one of those curmudgeonly type guys. So we're asking, why is it helpful? We know why it's helpful to understand we're not Naropa. Why is it helpful for someone to say they're probably not teachers like Dilopa at this moment? I think that was just a cautionary tale, because often people can misunderstand the relationship between teacher and student and think that they're expected to do more than they're capable of doing, or that they're asked to be doing more than they're capable of doing, and feeling like they have to do it. We know that there can be cults and things like that. So I don't think it was meant to be that there are no enlightened teachers at this moment, but more as students, we wouldn't be asked inappropriately to do things that were unhealthy. Okay, and now we'll do the bodhicitta prayer as our dedication. Page 24. Bodhicitta, the excellent and precious mind, where it is unborn, may it arise. Where it is born, may it not decline, but ever increase higher and higher. I think probably when you read the dedication prayers now, you'll have another perspective on the significance of dedication and the larger and larger views of dedication. You know, just not the simple of, by this virtue may I achieve omniscience and may all attain enlightenment, etc., but not only by this virtue, but by all the virtue collected by anyone in the three times, myself and all sentient beings, dedicating. He's teaching us how to get larger and larger, larger in our giving, larger in our dedication, larger in our aspirations. Go big. He's saying, go big. And in the next chapter, I think, is titled, we're going into awareness and mindfulness. So then he goes, oh, what I have done. Oh, my goodness. This is where I start. Really, this book is fabulous. So enjoy the poetry from this book. The verses that we were saying were our favorite verses people have collected and put into daily prayers. Shambhala does that as a daily prayer that's just gorgeous. Take the part that's most inspiring to you and really keep it close to your heart. And then we'll go to then how do we understand our mind, where is the root, and what do we do to get to the root, and what do we do to actually pull the root entirely up so it's never there again. We hope you will come back for the next one on mindfulness and awareness.